Cheshire Terrier, stretching and snuffling and yawning clouds into the cold morning air. Most published novels are a more intimate form of soap opera. Hines's The Gamekeeper is more like a handbook, a manual. The text, undivided by chapters, covers a year of a gamekeeper's life, or rather, of the work which determines his life. Because this work follows the seasons, when we reach the end, we are back at the beginning. The gamekeeper, aged about 40, is married with two sons. Previously, he was a steelworker. The setting is probably Yorkshire. Long before the book begins, he has left the steelworks to become one of the Duke's half-dozen gamekeepers. He is independent-minded. He feels good out of doors. He likes dogs and is fascinated by wildlife. His choice was towards a relatively larger freedom. But the purpose of his life's work now, with no holidays and less leisure than before, is absurd. He breeds and protects pheasants so that the Duke and six or seven of his associates can shoot 300 birds in a couple of days. Shoot and do nothing else. They do not carry or load their own guns. They do not walk. They do not train their dogs. They aim and pull the triggers. And they are not anachronisms. They are men of very considerable modern power. To ensure these powerful men their few hours of amusement, the gamekeeper daily throughout the year, and sometimes at night, pursues poachers, intimidates kids bird nesting or picking flowers, lays traps, ferrets rabbits, kills crows and magpies, shoots foxes, hatches the pheasants in incubators or under broody hens, feeds them absolutely regularly, administers medicine to them, releases them and watches over them so that on the prescribed day they can be driven by men with sticks towards the little line of trigger pullers. Such is the absurdity of his chosen life. He recognises the absurdity, yet he accepts it and in no way allows it to undermine his single-mindedness and efficiency as a gamekeeper. He gives himself over, just as the writing gives itself over, to all the practical tasks at hand. The gamekeeper removed the spade and placed the ferret at the entrance to the hole. He did not rush around to relieve his confinement or dash straight down the burrow. He just stood there for a moment, extended his head, snake-like, to confirm the judgment of the dog, then calmly walked into the dark. There was nothing extravagant about his movement. Yet he was all the more dangerous for his calm. Marginally, in the vitality of some of the wild birds or animals around him, the gamekeeper deposits his minimal belief that life has another dimension. While the gamekeeper was on his rounds and the boys were raking the rearing field, the pheasants inside the first incubator were starting to hatch. Cushioned in their sacks of water, protected by their shells, they'd been growing for 23 days, and now they filled their shells. They stirred. They had to peck their way out through the membrane, through the shell. This is a book that borders on despair. No emotions or feelings are described in it. The near despair resides in the contrast between the practicality of everything described and the unproductivity of the final outcome. A near despair with a profoundly proletarian origin. To assess the book, one must interrogate its meanings, the meaning of its method, in place of the endlessly exchanged opinions and constantly fluctuating feelings of the middle-class novel. It substitutes jobs, causes and effects. Its social meaning, without explicit judgment, it shows the difference between the lives of privileged and underprivileged. Its philosophical meaning. It describes a world in which the ruling class has succeeded in recycling nature. The game of the woods and moors has been proletarianized. It is fed and housed so as to produce the maximum surplus value, which, in this case, is the number of brace in the bag. The book also invents its own meaning, which is stronger than any other, and which Hines probably calculated less. This is the meaning of the gamekeeper's solitude, and the relation of this solitude to the will to live of animals. Here, I suspect, is where Hines's heart and obsession as a writer reside. His earlier novel, A Kestrel for a Knave, was also about